This is Monocle on Design. I'm Josh Fennett. On today's show...
I don't think there is a particular one thing that all women have brought to creative industries, but I do identify an approach to design amongst my peer group, and that is to move beyond, I guess, the monocultures established in the 20th century where we were designing for industry.
Design historian and writer Libby Sellers joins us to discuss the overlooked female design pioneers of the 20th century. And...
we're charged with taking that large, complicated mess of data and finding those human stories within it and telling that in a way that it's both impactful, elegantly simple, and speaks directly to, you know, their core audience.
How can illustration help articulate some of the world's most pressing concerns? We speak to the creative director of a smart biannual magazine, Weapons of Reason, to find out more. That, plus we cut a fashionable dash to peruse the shelves of a seemly Copenhagen retailer. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design. Do stay tuned. Now, our next guest thinks that when pressed to name a few pioneers of the design world, most people would come up with a list of predominantly male names. In fact, prior to the Bauhaus movement, women weren't even given the opportunity to study design. And when they did force their way into the limelight, women were often associated with skills such as textiles or ceramics, rather than architecture or industrial design. Nearly a century on, women's voices are still undoubtedly lacking from design publications, conferences, and judging panels. In her new book, Women Design, the writer and historian, plus the former curator at London's Design Museum, Libby Sellers, brings the profiles of 21 female designers to the forefront, ranging from the 20th century to today. This show's producer, Daphne Karnesis, sat down with Sellers to find out a little more.
Statistics show that nearly three quarters of student applications for creative industries are women. But when it comes to actually senior positions in the industry, it drops to one quarter being women. Somewhere we're losing them between education and industry. And I think this is an important thing to address, and maybe by presenting role models, by having people that have stood out, put their neck out there on the line, pioneered new levels, new industries, we might be able to encourage other women to do the same. The important thing for me was to show the diversity, that there was this great heritage of women working across all industries, from transport, textile, new media, graphics, product, architecture, you name it, and to show how that had been lost in the 20th century. Knowledge of that great heritage had been lost, and so the hope that we could learn from it today to not only encourage more women into the design industry, but hopefully keep them in the design industry.
And do you think that's also down to some, I guess, misconceptions? We all know the gender stereotypes when it comes to things like textile design or ceramics that have been considered maybe a bit more feminine.
Women weren't even allowed to study design until the early 20th century, so inevitably that had an impact on the disparity between the genders. Also, the way that design history has been narrated was largely written about by men, for men, about men, and it prioritised, certainly in terms of modernism, it prioritised architecture and industrial design, which were the preserves of men. So even how we learn about history has had this enormous gender bias going on through it. So yes, of course, women did practice textile, but there were many other women practicing architecture, industrial design, metalsmithing, engineering, but we just haven't heard about them so much.
In the book, you mentioned some big names like Ray Eames, Denise Scott Brown, Hella Jongerius, and Zaha Hadid, of course. And I noticed there were a few maybe lesser-known names that you've brought to the forefront.
Well, I think choosing 21 female designers from the last 120 years was always going to be a bit of a challenge. So yes, of course, there are some known names, but hopefully also some new stories that come along with those, you know, well-known names, as you say, Zaha Hadid and Ray Eames. But some of the perhaps underrepresented names I've written about in the book include Althea McNish, who was a Trinidadian-born textile designer who came to England at the time of the Windrush generation and had studied textile design at the Royal College of Art. She was a near contemporary of Lucien Day, and her textiles were just as popular as Lucien Day's, but for some reason we just haven't heard about her as much. And she's still alive today and she's a wonderful lady to meet, yet even she is quite dismissive of her own achievements. And I think that's a large thing that I came across in doing the research, is women, in all industries, suffer from a lack of confidence. And I think it's this need to sort of encourage them to be able to put their hand up and say, yes, I have achieved this and I can be proud, rather than deferring to their male colleagues or by perhaps stepping back and not being so vocal. We can identify them. Though other names obviously include Eva Zeisel, who was an amazing woman, lived until well into her hundreds and was designing right up until the day that she died. And hers is a fascinating story of moving from Europe to America in, you know, early part of the 20th century and struggling to find her way through. Unfortunately, she was so brilliant, and her ability to industrialize studio pottery enabled a whole generation of potters to go out and make a living.
Some of the women that you profile formed partnerships with their husbands. And how do you think that that affected their careers? Maybe we can talk about some examples.
When you're looking at case studies like Aino and Alva Aalto, or Charles and Ray Eames, or Lella and Massimo Vignelli, a lot of the times the women weren't always credited for the role that they brought into the partnership. Denise Scott Brown and Robert Venturi. Many times, actually, Robert Venturi is credited with more authorship of their famous book, Learning from Las Vegas. Actually, it was Denise Scott Brown's story that she wanted to tell. And then the horrible story when he was awarded the Pritzker Prize, and it was awarded to him alone, and he appealed to the Pritzker Committee asking if it could be a joint award, and he was turned down, saying, no, the Pritzker historically only gives it to one person, and in this case it would be him. And that has come up time and time again with lots of appeals and protests, with Denise Scott Brown being encouraged to be included in the award. Subsequently, the battle continues. They haven't won it.
And I love some of the specific photos in the book that you've selected for each of these women, some portraits of themselves, some more austere, some more relaxed, that I think are really telling about the lives of these women beyond strictly their work. What did you discover through the process that maybe you didn't know before?
I studied design history at the Royal College of Art, joint with the Victoria and Albert Museum, but that was quite a few decades ago. I know my design history, but I don't know everything. So I was very happy and very privileged to be able to delve into these women's lives. There were names in there that I hadn't really written about before and certainly never researched. Kazuo Sejima, the contemporary Japanese architect, I'd never had the opportunity to write about her before. So learning about her practice and seeing the nuances that she brought into contemporary architecture. Similarly, Patrizia Urquiola, the amazing contemporary furniture and industrial designer, reading some of her stories, hearing how it took actually her mentor, Piero Lassoni, to push her out into the world to set up her own studio, because prior to that, she thought that it wasn't a woman's job to be able to do that. And these were real little anecdotes that sort of made me warm to a lot of the women that were in the book. The one thing that I found really frustrating in doing it was actually, I mean, it was slightly self-imposed because of not being able to travel extensively and not having a lot of access to primary source material, was just how little documentation there is in non-Western cultures. There was a particular architect called Manette De Silva, who was Sri Lankan, working in about the 1940s. And unfortunately, due to the ravages of time and nature, a lot of her buildings have been lost. Or a Japanese designer, furniture designer, called Hisake Watanabe, who was working in the 1980s, very much Memphis aesthetic. Because a lot of the text written about her was in Japanese, I couldn't access it.
And we've been speaking about female designers, women designers. Is there a danger, do you think, that women in the design sector are too often considered in the context of their gender, just by the way that they're referred? I mean, a few weeks ago, we had a show where we spoke to the first female director of the AA, the Architectural Association in London, and also the first female dean at Columbia University. And they both said that, you know, ideally, they'll be happy when they're just sort of referred to as designers, not necessarily female designers. What do you think about that?
I actually came across this issue in doing the book. There are a couple of people that didn't want to be written about as a woman designer. They felt that the quality of the work and should stand alone. And I think that's absolutely fair point. So I respected their request and we moved on. But I think you can't have a meritocracy until you have equality. And I think we're a long way away from equality. So yes, I agree with the director of the AA and all these other women that are saying, I want to be counted as a designer, not a woman designer. But then again, I think it's important with this point about role models. I think it is important that we stand up and acknowledge that, you know, I am a woman, fine, if that's the gender you associate with. But I'm also a designer. The two don't have to be mutually exclusive. And a question I've been asked a lot since writing the book is, have I identified a particular feminine aesthetic that's come into design since researching? I don't think there is a particular one thing that all women have brought to creative industries, but I do identify an approach to design amongst my peer group, and that is to move beyond, I guess, the monocultures established in the 20th century where we were designing for industry. Now people are designing for other people. And I think that's human-centered design that actually a lot of my female colleagues are really achieving very, you know, high level of success in. Designers such as Ilse Crawford is, you know, she's the obvious one to state here. You know, every single one of her projects starts with how the space will be used by people, not overriding aesthetic that she imposes onto the interiors that she creates. I do get this idea of gender neutrality, but it's a very nuanced and very complex subject. I think we're a way away from it yet.
Our sincere thanks to Libby Sellers there, who was speaking to Monocle's Daphne Karnesis. Women Design is published by Francis Lincoln and available at all self-respecting bookshops now. Infographics have existed from around the same time as Europe's very first daily newspapers, but in an age of inaccuracy, fake news and large streams of data, clever graphic design could well help to articulate and decode some of today's most pressing concerns. Weapons of Reason is a biannual magazine that set itself that very task. The publication is the project of London-based design agency Humans After All, and each issue visually unpacks a theme from megacities to ageing or power. The current issue takes a bite out of the world of food. And I'm joined now by the creative director of the magazine, Paul Willoughby, who is the co-founder and executive creative director at Human After All. He's a graphic designer himself and also the former creative director of Little White Lies magazine.
So our grounding is in publishing. We started Little White Lies in 2005 and somewhat explored data design within that, only dipping our toe in really. And then obviously we had several clients, including the World Economic Forum, where quite complicated data had to be displayed in a very palatable format for a whole number of different subsets of audience, you know, from high-level thinkers, policymakers, government heads. So we ended up really learning a lot of craft around data there and how to tell a great story through data and while still holding on to the core concept and the core values. And some of those data points were shared digitally. They were shared on social channels of the World Economic Forum. And we found a lot of value in shareable cards. So, you know, as soon as something's created in print, it has a lot of life within digital channels. You know, it can actually spread out over a whole number of channels within a square crop shareable cards. So we've just found that both are really symbiotic. You know, like the magazine becomes the central nucleus of the idea of the idea space. And then out of that comes this whole sort of halo effect of different shareable tidbits of information and data.
And to delineate for listeners, I suppose, the two things that we're talking about here, Human After All is the design studio that you run, and Weapons of Reason is the rather beautifully printed magazine. I have two issues here in front of me, and before we jump under the covers, if you'll excuse the very rude implication there, I'd like to ask you, we seem to have more data than ever, you know, barely a day passes when I don't read a headline about another piece of information that is being gathered about me by one of the great powers in the world at the minute, by social media or whatever, but also the data we gather about the number of marine species that are endangered by the amount of plastic we're putting in the oceans. The amount of plastic we're putting in the oceans itself is a new piece of data that perhaps 5-10 years ago we wouldn't have had such ready access to. How is illustration helping us kind of grapple with these big numbers that can seem so intractable?
Great question. I mean, in our latest issue, the food issue, we do look at microplastics and how that they've made their way into the ocean, you know.
So these are the fun beads that everyone thought were going to help exfoliate
their
skin.
Yeah, these are the fun, colourful little beads which are sort of glitter over the ocean surface. I mean, there's a huge garbage patch floating somewhere off the coast of California. And we illustrated that by saying, you know, it's basically five times as big as the UK. It's an enormous volume and it's just swirling around out there in its mass.
It's a terrible image. I wonder sometimes, can an image do something? There's an old adage to this effect, but can an image do something that words can't?
In this case, yes. I think people are obsessed with volumes. You know, how big is this thing compared to this other thing? So a lot of our interrogation into data is merely showing the comparative size of things, basically. It's looking at, you know, how does this thing compare to something that you already know, basically. So how do you grasp this huge concept unless you have some idea of just how big it is? So, you know, we use things that people are already very familiar with, that they can latch on to, which allows them to interrogate the data themselves, which we hope in turn will, you know, start to push buttons in terms of their behavior, sort of decisions they make, their consumer choices. That's really where the magazine hopes to go.
And I'm interested in the editorial and the commercial divide. I mean, we're sitting here in Monocle's headquarters in Midori House. On the floor above Monocle is our sister agency, Wink Creative, which is a branding agency. Although there are areas where we don't discuss what's going on because there's a clear conflict of interest, there are ideas that we share about the world. And I assume that's true of Weapons of Reason and Human after all. Is one a shop window for the other, in a way? This is how we treat information, and this is what we can do as a commercial service, and this is how we think about the world editorially. Is there a little bit of a symbiosis between the two products, two ways of thinking?
Absolutely. I mean, I think any agency really, to some degree, wants to create a product which really comes from their heart, that reflects the authenticity at the heart of the agency. And Weapons of Reason is that for us. You know, it's a shop window in some case. People can peer in and see what we're all about. We're all about humanizing things like data, what we're talking about today, but also the storytelling aspect, you know, taking people on a journey throughout an issue. The issues are split into the past, the present, and the future. And the past really gives this emotional grounding to an issue, to allow things that you may already know to sort of manifest in your mind. And then the present will just inform you as to exactly what's going on now and what you should be informed of. And then the future is that sort of glimpse into the future, some good things, some bad things, but it's important that people know exactly what's going on. And then in our client work, we've been blessed with clients with similar mindsets that come to our door. You know, we've done some work with Greenpeace, for instance, who saw the symbiosis with themselves. You know, the kind of issues we were covering were exactly what they were working on at the time. So we were lucky enough to get to do a few campaigns for those guys. And we're also doing a campaign at the moment, kind of top secret. All will be revealed soon.
And just as a final question, I'd like to confront the precipice that many media agencies have found themselves at, and digital agencies and design agencies, I suppose, too. It's this mix between getting the right ratio between online content and physical content. And there's a metaphor that Monocle's editor uses. He says, the same guy that gets angry about having very slow Wi-Fi in the coffee shop is a guy who will wait 10 minutes for a drip coffee because he sees value in a certain physical thing, but also has value in another digital thing. Does information, does graphic design work on those two levels? You can quickly consume a piece of information. Maybe if you're working for Greenpeace and you need to get a point across, you can revel in the information, perhaps in a story and unpack it in the magazine. Is the future two speed, or will digital win out, or will we all go back to print? What do you think?
That's a very big question, but an absolutely great one. Obviously, coming from publishing, we see the merits in publishing. We see the strength in gathering so many great ideas within one consumable package. And then for us, we see it as completely symbiotic. You know, the digital can feed from the print. And maybe the print isn't actually the core of the project, so to speak, the spiritual core. You know, maybe the spiritual core is the actual brand itself, the idea behind the magazine. So we're currently interrogating just how, what is that spiritual core of the magazine? What are the guiding principles? The design of the magazine is obviously very strongly coloured. There is a, you know, bespoke font at work within the magazine, a very templated approach to the pages. You know, we don't want to confuse people. We almost want people to know what they're going to expect, you know, like, and if people know what they're going to expect, they tend to sign up to your brand and know that that value is going to reach them every single time, you know, whether it's within a digital communication or within the printed article itself.
So good brands are still built through repetition.
Brands is key. You know, like, obviously there's a huge conversation about around what is a brand. To us, it's a set of ideas, and how do you articulate those ideas within the visual realm and, you know, also the tone of voice? So we spend a lot of time figuring out, you know, what are the core tenets to the editorial response? What are the guiding principles when it comes to visuals? There's basically 19 colours within the whole magazine. There's no other colours at work. So when we commission illustration, we ask an illustrator, can you choose a limited palette from these 19 colours and find your idea and expression within that? And then, you know, down to the bespoke font itself, we thought, what is the voice of reason? If there is a voice of reason, what does it look like? You know, and we decided that it sounded somewhat like, if it was to be orated, it would sound like David Attenborough. So you'll see in the typeface, it's geometric, so it has a very strong structure, but the corners are rounded, so it lands softly. You know, it doesn't shout at you, it just speaks in a very soft voice, but it's still quite persuasive and has some depth to it, like the man himself.
Many thanks to Paul Willoughby, Creative Director of Weapons of Reason magazine. Do pick up a copy. One departure from the growing doom and gloom around the hardships of high street retail comes in the form of Copenhagen-based menswear shop Goods. The retailer has bucked the trend with a confident brick-and-mortar revamp that's gaining traction amongst the city's style-conscious residents. Now celebrating its 10th anniversary, the shop, founded by local Kasper Hostrup in the aftermath of the financial downturn, is choosing to celebrate the landmark by preparing his outlet for the next 10 years with an extensive refit. Our editorial assistant, Jonathan Whitfield, visited the store to find out how.
Celebrating their 10th anniversary this month, menswear shop Goods Copenhagen are going from strength to strength in the world of brick-and-mortar retail. After visiting Midori House and chatting to Monocle's business editor Matt Allegaya on The Entrepreneurs about his commercial success, I catch up with founder Kasper Hostrup about their newly revamped shop in the north of the city.
We've been around for 10 years and we wanted to set sales for another 10 years. So our thought is, should we open another store or should we redo this store and make the best store that we could possibly do and have people come to this one store instead of spreading out and opening more stores? Once we decided on that we wanted to rebuild the store, then we also wanted to find some partners who are actually in the business of rebuilding and some professionals. And we have a customer who's been with us since the beginning, since we started in a small basement in the next street. And he actually used to be a wallpaper editor, interior editor, and now he has his own interior design company called OEO. We chose him because he knew our journey, he knew what we stand for, and so it was a quite easy pick to choose him. And luckily, he wanted to work with us as well, because that wasn't a given, obviously. Second, we wanted to use materials for the rebuild, the refurbishment, that emulated the clothes that we are selling. So we are selling quality clothing, it's very tactile clothing, so we wanted to use material which had the same feel and had some, also just like we use a lot of really nice colors, warm colors on when we do the selection, and we wanted something that simulated that as well. So we used a lot of wood, a lot of brass, we had a coconut carpet, and like really like warm materials, and also materials that are long lasting, because we would like to try to do a refurbishment that could last at least the next 10 years. But if we manage to do something that is as timeless as most of the clothes that we are selling, you could also just leave it, because the quality of the product, the quality of the refurbishment can last 20 years or 30 years if we want to keep it. So that was quite important to us.
While other successful retail outlets invest into new branches in new areas, Goods is taking a different approach. As business is booming, I ask Kasper why he took the unique approach to reinvigorate rather than expand the brand.
We wanted to do the absolutely best that we can do, and we are also very aware of that we can always do better. And one of the things that we thought that we could do much better was the interior, so that's why we choose to do that. And it's very easy to have people to go out of the center of cities, and you can even be in a backyard somewhere in Brooklyn and have people come there, because due to, I think, social media and everything is very accessible. So it's not that hard to have people come to a store, just one store, because they're used to it. They're used to going to that one restaurant, which is completely offbeat, and they go there because they give something extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And we want to give that extraordinary to the ones that take their time to come visit us. And we have a lot of customers in greater Copenhagen who's they ask us, why don't you open a second store like in my area? And the response is always, but you're here
anyway.
You're here now anyway, so we don't need to do that, because we can give you something that you can't get anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And that's why you're willing to travel for it. And at the same time, our greatest competition is obviously online, and we wanted to present our product and selection and everything in an environment that you cannot emulate online. Mm-hmm. And that's also for us, it's very important that the customers, like, they feel the clothes, they feel the tactileness of everything that we have, and that includes also the interior. Mm-hmm. From the beginning, it's quite important for us to brand the store and not the brands that we are actually selling in the store. So when you look at the selection that we have in store, you would see all brands mixed together, like your own wardrobe. Mm-hmm. We don't present single selection of brands, because nobody buy the product that way. I don't know anybody that has just one brand in their wardrobe. So from the beginning, it's been about people. We wanted people to say that I bought a shirt at Goods today, not I bought our legacy shirt today. Yeah. That's been the idea from the beginning, and now 10 years later, it definitely pays off. Mm. So Goods is the brand, not the product. We have good product, but the Goods is definitely the brand. We have both an online store and a retail store, but we see the most increase in our retail business, and that's why we're investing in that. And we have a huge belief in the retail business, and in the fact that the online business is growing so rapidly makes space for us. We get even more important to people, because it gets fewer and fewer stores like ours.
Yeah. Sure.
So, and fewer and fewer are investing in the way that we are doing in retail, and people find it unique, and we're happy for it.
Yeah.
Reflecting Casper's curation of clothing, the refurbishment of the store considers the needs of the discerning shopper by pairing well-made apparel with a likewise meticulously crafted setting. With the decline of the high street and the prevalence of online shopping, smaller scale ventures such as Goods with a personal feel go a long way. For Monocle in Copenhagen, this is Jonathan Whitfield.
Jonathan Whitfield in Copenhagen there, speaking to Casper Hostrup about his shop Goods seemingly new revamp. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. Don't forget, you can listen to our sister show, Monocle on Design Extra, each Thursday, or unpack more delights in the pages of Monocle magazine. Today's show was produced by Daphne Karnizis, researched by Julia Webster Ayuso, and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.